You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show with your host, Brian Callen.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Brian Callen Show. This is Hunter Toto Motz pulling back the curtain to show you that there is no wizard. There is only a man pulling some levers. And it is my great pleasure today to bring on a woman who is checking abuses of intellectual power, Kathy O'Neill, who has written an awesome book called Weapons of Math Destruction. Or WMDs. Kathy O'Neill, welcome on the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
So, Kathy, tell us how the math that you love has been misused to do harm.
Yeah, I'm a mathematician and I love math. And I worked as a math professor for a while and then decided at exactly the wrong time, 2006, to look into becoming a hedge fund quantitative analyst. So I joined the hedge fund D.E. Shaw in 2007, just in time for the world to collapse around me. And I was sort of like witness to really destructive uses of mathematics. I should mention that the hedge fund did not invest directly in mortgage-backed securities, as far as I know, but we did like learn about them. And it was the first example, one of the first examples, and I'm going to start that again if that's okay. And I was working at the hedge fund D.E. Shaw, and although they didn't invest directly into mortgage-backed securities, we learned about them because there was stuff going on all around us. And I found that it was a weaponized form of mathematics. So AAA ratings, in particular, is what I'm talking about. The AAA ratings on mortgage-backed securities were mathematical lies. And I say mathematical lies because on the one hand, they looked mathematical. Like people were told, hey, this AAA rating means that there are mathematicians with PhDs doing like their due diligence behind the curtain over at Moody's and S&P and Fitch. And they're making sure that these investments are safe. In actuality, they were just selling those AAA ratings in order to get money. So there was no real integrity to those ratings. And it was the first example of the weaponization of mathematics that I found happened actually a lot in the world of big data as well.
Well, and I think that's the interesting thing is, you know, when the 2008 housing crisis happened, I kept on thinking about the classic book on market follies, This Time is Different. And, you know, each time there's a different reason why you have one of these bubbles, right? You know, it's tulips or the South Sea Land bubble or whatever it may be. And this time, you know, it was dot-coms in 99. And then this time, oh, it's housing. But I think the big difference is we've always sort of rationalized that. But now because of math, the rationalizations are so complex that the general public doesn't feel comfortable holding that math accountable.
Absolutely. You know, the complexity of it, of the mortgage-backed securities themselves is part of why we had to rely, and I say we, I mean investors had to rely on these AAA ratings completely, crucially, right? So it was too complicated for a normal person to understand, even an insider, for them to understand it. So they had to rely on this rating system, and the rating system itself was secret, but it had a sort of a mathematical imprimatur. It had like this cloak of authenticity and respectability because it was mathematical in nature. And the fact that people are both afraid of mathematics and they admire mathematics, it's this weird combination that keeps people from asking questions. They don't understand it, but they don't feel like they're expert enough to ask more questions. So they just accept it. And because they've accepted it and because they actually trust it, the scale of the mortgage-backed securities and the scale of the housing bubble was kind of like infinite, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we've had bubbles before.
Mm-hmm.
But the question is, why was this one so bad? And the answer in large part is the AAA ratings were very, very deeply trusted by international investors.
Yep. And we've had a lot of academics on this show. And it's interesting the degree to which there are a lot of people, for example, the behavioral economists are trying to get rid of the people who believe in rational agent theory. And, you know, what's interesting is, I mean, you know, Richard Thaler has this great story about him. He's at dinner. It's him, a psychologist and an economist. And, you know, the economist is talking about what idiots people are, right? And he's like, my wife is an idiot because she just bought a new car and she never drives it because she doesn't want to, you know, ding it up. And that's so economically irrational. And then he says, and my students are idiots, you know, they just like don't understand the most basic economic concepts. And so at some point, the psychologist leans over and says, how come all the people that you know are idiots, but all the people in your models are geniuses?
Oh, really good question.
Yeah. And so the economist proceeds to go like, oh, well, and then proceeds to like wave his hands about. And Richard Thaler calls it the invisible hand wave. and just in general, there's been a real breakdown in accountability, I think, among smart people because they can create such complex rationalizations that even they fool themselves. But at the end of the day, it's emotional and you like your pet theory or you really want to believe that you have found a way to make money in the market that just can't lose.
Yeah, and the sort of the kind of cultural level, like I entered, as I said, I entered finance in 2007,
mm-hmm.
and I entered it at a moment of like a peak hubris, I think.
Yeah.
Certainly compared to what I saw 2 years later by the time I left the hedge fund. You know, people, it's just a sort of human nature that people, when they get rich,
mm-hmm.
based on like bets they take, based on risks that they decide to undertake, and then they win that bet, they get money, and this keeps happening for years and years. It accumulates their trust in themselves, mm-hmm. and they're very smug. And I think it really doesn't have to do with understanding why it's true. It's just in some sense it's like it's true because I am successful with a capital S. So I think that part, there was like certainly that tendency that was playing a part. People didn't. They didn't have enough nervousness, right? And they didn't ask the hard questions and say, show me the data. They were like, no, I know this is going to work because I just feel good about it.
Well, and also, and I, you know, we've had a lot of evolutionary psychologists on here. And I think the other point that's worth recognizing is just how male that culture is. And, you know, I mean, realistically, like, you know, I love my gender. I think we've contributed some good things to humanity. And I think we've done some terrible things along the way, too. And, you know, we tend to be myopically focused on, you know, killing that big kill. We want that hunt. We want the big money. We want to bring home the bacon. And we don't sort of think about.
You don't have to tell me.
Yeah. So how much?
The only woman there.
Exactly.
I was the only woman quant.
So tell us about like what is it like being, and do you think that being a woman helped in terms of recognizing what was going on?
I mean, again, like we didn't at our hedge fund, we didn't actually invest in the mortgage-backed securities, as far as I know. But like, I think being a woman helped? It helped me from ever sort of falling prey to the idea that I am measured by my bonus,
right?
Which I found completely ludicrous.
Mm-hmm.
I should mention that not only was I already a professor at Barnard College by the time I took this job, but I also had two children, and mm-hmm. they were, you know, not babies; they were kids. And so I sort of thought of myself as a sort of a culture maker, you know, like I decide what is right or wrong in this family, you know, and then I go into a sort of what I can only describe as like a hazing culture, you know, at a hedge fund where everything is secret. And like the boss actually tried to make us more competitive. He bought like a foosball table so that we would get more competitive with each other.
Mm.
And it was bizarre and I was having none of it. So there were some part of me that as a woman and as a mother, I was just like, this is not going to like infiltrate my psyche. At the same time, like I think on a mathematical level, on a sort of statistical level, I being a professor, I was not insecure. And I just don't have a kind of intellectual insecurity that a lot of the people who came in with me did, because most of them were coming in just straight out of PhDs.
Right.
So I had a little bit more experience under my belt, and I didn't mind asking really stupid questions.
Yeah.
Which ended up being not so stupid questions, if
yeah.
you know what I mean.
No, you know, I do. Thinking,
okay, this theory tells us that in, you know, when there's no liquidity, when there's infinite liquidity and no transaction costs, then such and such is true. And I'm like, but what if liquidity isn't infinite? And everybody was like, Kathy, liquidity is always infinite.
Yeah, exactly. You know? That's the religious article. There will always be infinite liquidity, you know? If we just flap our lips hard enough, then there will be infinite liquidity. But I mean, the reason why I ask, and, you know, I just think, you know, that that's one of the arguments. There are all these arguments that are made for breaking the glass ceiling on fairness. But I think, you know, the other argument is just that, like, when you get a bunch of bros together, there's a certain psychology that develops, and it doesn't necessarily think about the larger societal consequences of things. And so, you know, I mean, do you really want a frat in charge of your economy? I don't think so. I think it would be much more beneficial to have sort of a, you know, a lot of different perspectives. That's my main point.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with you. I mean, I wrote a blog post last year saying I don't want more women at Davos, basically because I'm like, why would we want a bunch of women at like a circle jerk?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I don't, you know, it's such an unappealing concept to me that instead of having like pushing for 50% women, I think we should push for it to be over and to end and to not ever happen again.
Right. Exactly.
So, yeah. I mean, and going back to your point, like, I do think that I'm the only person I know of anyway from that experience, at least at D.E. Shaw, that like quit the company because I didn't want to be part of it. You know,
right.
Because I was like, the moral ramifications for me personally are not good enough for to be made up for by the money. You know, and like, I do think that's a sort of common theme in my life, which is like, I'm working in an industry where people are kind of, yeah, it's not so great for the world, but it pays well. And I'm going to stick with it. And I'm like, no, it's not worth it. I'm leaving. My kids make fun of me. They say I'm like a professional job quitter. but I feel like until I have a job where I'm actually proud of what I'm accomplishing, I'm going to quit that job.
But aren't you proud of what you've done with Weapons of Mass Destruction?
I really am. I really am. I feel like that's something I chose to do, right? I quit. I was, you know, so after leaving finance, I worked as a data scientist. I like reinvented myself, which was very, very easy because it was almost the same kind of technical tools, mm-hmm. Being a quant in finance, predicting the market, as being a data scientist in startups, predicting clicks and things like that. So it wasn't hard for me to transfer. But then I worked there for a while, and I kept on finding more and more examples of like weaponizations of mathematics and mathematical algorithms. And at some point I had accumulated enough information and seen enough of a pattern to say, gosh, this is terrible and I should write a book about it. So like, that was the moment when I quit that job to write this book. That was like, since then I've actually been much happier.
Well, and I think the interesting thing as sort of, again, one of those patterns that you're talking about is the fact that, you know, there has been this mythologized version of both capitalism and evolution that it's all about selfishness. You know, Dawkins wrote his Selfish Gene, and that was Jeff Skilling's favorite book. And then he ran Enron on the principles of selfishness and just, you know, unfettered competition. And it blew up because it turns out there really is no I in team. And there really isn't. I mean, like, if you run your company that way, it will eventually self-destruct. And there's a group of evolutionary psychologists evolutionary biologists who are trying to correct that, called the multi-level selection group. And what David Sloan Wilson and E.O. Wilson wrote is that selfish individuals beat altruistic individuals, but altruistic groups beat selfish groups. So the point is that, you know, if you want to rip everybody off, you can get ahead personally. But you're actually, if you're as part of a group that really works together and is a team and sort of thinks about the larger success of the group, will actually beat a group that is selfish. And I think that sort of very simple doctrine is not something that most companies understand. And the ones that do, like Pixar, do really well. And the ones that don't, like Enron, blow up.
I would add to that, I mean, I don't disagree with anything you just said, but I would add that if you need a critical mass of you know, somewhat cooperative, altruistic people in a company to make it work,
mm-hmm.
right? So if you have like a bunch of Ayn Rand fans, you know, in a company, and someone comes in who's a hippie, and I'm speaking of myself,
mm-hmm.
like, it is a really unattractive place to stay,
yeah.
right? So you need a critical mass, and I haven't seen that a lot happening a lot. The world of finance, for the most part, seems populated with a bunch of Jamie Dimons.
Yep.
So there's a little bit of like real world evolution in action there.
Mm-hmm.
So you get like sort of people that don't want to work in that kind of environment leave, and the people who are absolutely fine working in that kind of cutthroat, unempathetic environment stay. And that's how you get these people who run these kinds of these banks and these large corporations.
But that's sort of a, I mean, I think for those of us who aren't in finance or, for example, aren't in Wall Street, that's a, or in Washington, D.C., that's kind of the problem is nobody who's a decent person would want to stay at one of those hedge funds and nobody who's a decent person would want to work in Washington, D.C. And so the result is that you end up with a bunch of Jamie Dimons. And,
yeah.
You know, there's the problem is that they're in charge of a very powerful institution and they can wreak a tremendous amount of havoc on us all.
Yeah. And I just want to make the point that, like, if you look at Debbie Wasserman Schultz, you know, who's not I'm not a fan of, you realize it's not really a male female thing.
Yeah. Oh, no, I think DWS, you know, did a lot of damage. I mean, you know, we had Lawrence Lessig on this podcast and he was our candidate. And, you know, we didn't think he was going to win necessarily, but we thought that it was useful and helpful to have him in the debate so that we could at least be talking about campaign finance.
Totally.
And so, you know, we supported him. But the problem was is that to even get into the debates, you had to be officially invited by the Democratic Party. And so DWS, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, the Catherine Harris of this election, didn't even invite him. And,
right.
You know, the result was that you had Bernie and Hillary and then, you know, that guy from Maryland who, you know, was just sort of like, it's really cool to be here, guys. Like, it's so exciting to be in the running.
It's definitely a political system that is afraid of open debate. And
yeah.
It's really sad. And I agree. Like, I've been thinking, like, how to, like, given the you know, presidential election results, like, how are we going to reinvent the left? And, like, it's not at all obvious because of all these ridiculously tight rules on and there's the stranglehold of the old guard and the Democratic Party. So I don't know. It's got to happen, but I don't know how it's going to happen.
Well, can I offer you a narrative?
Please.
So, yeah, because we have a very unique experience here because we, you know, sort of interview. I mean, we've interviewed over 200 people. You will be episode 223, I think, or 222.
I hope 222 just because I like that number.
That's a great number, right? I mean, you know, there obviously a mathematician likes a certain mathematical tidiness. I wish it was 314, you know, I mean, but unfortunately. But so we've had, you know, a lot of people on this show. And so, you know, when you see sort of that many academics in that many fields, you start to get an overview of what's going on that maybe most people don't have the privilege of having. So I think the first thing to realize is that Donald Trump sold a very simple narrative, which appealed to my Midwestern relatives, which is there were 1,000 jobs here. They went to China and 1,000 jobs will come back. And that's not true because,
right.
As the left knows, it's actually about automation and robotics.
Right.
And we're reaching the end of routine work. So
the
first thing that I think has to be done is you have to move that narrative, because if you move that narrative, then that fundamentally displaces Donald's narrative. And then you realize that, and this is the other part, is that in general, most people in politics are talking about skills. So they're saying, oh, we need to give people skills. We need to retrain people in skills. But skills are routine tasks. It's exactly what robots do well. So this isn't about skills retraining. This is something much more fundamental. And what that much more fundamental thing is, America needs a Meiji restoration. Because essentially, you know, Japan was a feudal society, and then Commodore Perry showed up in Tokyo Harbor with his black ships, and the Japanese were like, oh, crap. Well, we've been shut away from the world for 200 years. Everything's moved on, and so we need to reinvent our society. And so what they did is essentially they swapped out the engine of Japanese society, so it moved from being a feudal society to an industrial age society. And we now need to swap out the engine of what for many people is still an industrial age society and create an information age society. And that means that, for example, you know, rednecks are going to have to learn to like book learning. And that is not something that my relatives want to do. And it's a struggle for them because they're generally not emotionally aware or self-aware. And they don't understand that if you, it's a feeling, like you have a feeling about books. And if you hate books, you're not going to engage with them. And if you like books, you will engage with them. And you need to manage and change your own feelings. And there are a series of cultural traits that need to change, like embracing mistakes, liking information, knowing how to manage both optimism and pessimism, and then these other two mindsets, atomism and holism. And, you know, we just fundamentally need a much more reflective culture. So how's that?
Well, I don't think it's going to work. I don't think it's going to work. I mean, as you said, your relatives aren't going to buy it.
Oh, they're not going to buy it currently. But the point is that I think the point is not so much that it's not going to work. I think it's literally that you don't have a choice. There are larger historical forces.
I do think there are a lot of things that we don't have a choice about, but I don't think framing it in terms of like loving books. I don't know. I just disagree with you. I think that what we need to do is redefine what it means to have dignity as a human being. And we have to think about the basic income guarantee, but we can't just call it welfare and make people will be happy about it, because people have this idea that in order to be a dignified human and lead a dignified existence, they have to have a job, and they have to have a job at a factory, and they can't have a job taking care of old people, for example, which is actually one of the only industries that really is going to grow. So we have to redefine what it is to live a dignified existence. And I think that's hard, but I don't think it has to be information.
Well, it doesn't have to be information. It can also be caring. It can be whatever it may be. I mean, I think regardless, even if you are working in a nursing home, I think fundamentally you're a voter, and voters need to be well informed, as this election proved. And, you know, part of what we've all sort of been victim of is specialization, where, you know, we are very good at a particular thing, and we have that narrow knowledge that pays our job, but we don't have the broad knowledge that allows us to make voting decisions. You need to be in, even if you're working in a nursing home, you need to understand education, healthcare, foreign policy, all of these things, have a worldview that's broad enough that you can actually make sense of what's going on. But to your point about dignity, I mean, I think Daniel Pink did a good job of sort of creating a good schema for this, of, you know, moving from motivation 1.0, which is sort of fear-based motivation, you know, Hobbes's Leviathan, motivation 2.0 is capitalism, and then motivation 3.0 is essentially what we need now, which is autonomy, mastery, and purpose. And I think you can absolutely give everybody a guaranteed universal minimum income, and then fundamentally, with that in place, then they are going to be focused on the pursuit of dignity rather than the pursuit of wealth.
I think we could agree on that. And I also think I would absolutely agree with you that the internet, which was supposed to be some democratization of information and freeing of information, has been everything but that. The recent spate of false and misleading information that people are constantly being bombarded with on the Facebook algorithm streams is really having a terrible, pernicious effect on the way people think about politics, the way people think about facts versus opinion, the way people evaluate candidates on their personality versus their actual policy. And I think we can ask people to ask for more and ask for better information, but we could also just address it directly with Facebook and with Google. I think they have a part to play in this. And right now, they're just denying all responsibility.
Well, of course they are. But the Silicon Valley, I mean, you know, this election is Silicon Valley's toxic waste. You know, they're the ones who automated all these jobs and made the technology possible so that these people in the Midwest don't have jobs, and then didn't deal with the human factor of helping them transition into a new society. And then also, yeah, absolutely, you know, it's again, it's that difference between selfishness and self-interest. You know, if you're selfish and you're Facebook, you just want everybody to be on there as much as possible, so you create an echo bubble. But if you're self-interested, then you want everybody to be on there and you make some money, but at the same time, you're creating a well-informed populace so that they can vote well. So, again, you know, greed is not good.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, I wouldn't put all of the blame at Silicon Valley's feet, because a lot of the industries that have left the Rust Belt were not technology industries. But I agree with you that nobody really has a plan for how to compensate the people that have lost in the last 25 years of globalization and automation.
Yeah, and I mean, I think the crucial thing is what you're saying as well, is that, you know, work is fundamentally, it's not just about paying your bills, it's about dignity. And if you don't give, I mean, that's the, you know, my dad works for a think tank in the Middle East that is focused on counterterrorism. And his boss is a Muslim cleric. And, you know, he's like, this all comes down to one thing, dignity. There's no way for these young men to achieve dignity within Arab society. So instead, they go looking for it from ISIS.
So that's an example of a culture we do not want to emulate.
Yeah.
But you gave an example of Japan, how they really learned how to change the way they thought. I wonder if we can come up with an example or would we have to be the first of an example of a sort of post-industrial society that's figured out how to value each other and ourselves without necessarily working in a factory or getting a a lot of money at their job.
Well, a large part of it is understanding sort of how culture works. And so what emerges from all this research, and again, I'm just pulling it together, but, you know, everybody has optimism and pessimism, but some cultures massively overfavor optimism and some cultures massively overfavor pessimism. So America massively overfavors optimism with the result that it's happy and productive, but consistently has delusional foreign policy, right? That's the downside of being optimistic. Pessimists, you know, are massively realistic, overly aware of threats, but that means that they are prepared to deal with all threats and, you know, they tend to have substance abuse problems. So lawyers are overwhelmingly pessimists and, you know, they have huge rates of substance abuse and so are Russians. But the emergence of all of this is that you're not actually, like, if you want to be the most productive culture, you're actually neither American nor Russian. What you do is you use optimism and pessimism selectively in order to be able to, A, be realistic about any threats or challenges, and then, B, have the optimism to actually carry things out. So the sort of culture that would emerge is not going to be a culture. You can keep the symbols. It's just like Japan did, right? They didn't stop eating sushi. But, you know, you're fundamentally going to end up with a way of thinking that uses, you know, optimism, pessimism, atomism and holism, which is the whole East-West divide, honor and dignity, which is the North-South divide of the United States. But essentially all of these mindsets as tools rather than as sort of truths.
Well, first of all, I love sushi.
Who doesn't love sushi?
Yeah. And I'd say that, you know, it's interesting you say we're optimistic. I think, you know, one of the things that Trump did is he managed to be optimistic at the same time as being incredibly hateful.
Yeah.
And that's something I haven't wrapped my head around. But he's managed to convince many of his supporters that these jobs are coming back and or they're going to have pride and dignity, even if they don't have their job, at the same time as sort of pairing that with really, truly hateful rhetoric. And so, like, what do we have to invent a new dimension where it's like hateful optimism?
No. It's so, you know, Kathy, you haven't had the benefit of spending enough time around actors in L.A. So actors in let me explain to you actor psychology, which is really psychology of the Trump supporter. So actors are the most optimistic humans on the planet because you have to be really delusional to think that you're going to move to LA and be the one to make it. Right?
Oh, my God. Yes.
Yeah.
How do they do that?
Well, so that's the point. They're just like crazy optimistic, but it also means they're crazy delusional. And so what they do is they sit around waiting to get discovered. They think that, like, through some magical transmogrification, they're just going to be sitting in a cafe.
They're going to be the one.
And they're going to be the one and they're going to be discovered, right? But there's this other side to it, which is at some point that bubble gets burst and they realize I'm 75 and I've only ever done a guest star role one time on a TV show back in the 1970s. Oh, crap. And then a crushing pessimism sets in. So if you have middle America and they've been so believing in the American dream for so long and then it doesn't show up, right? And then a crushing pessimism sets in. But then because they don't actually have a realistic worldview, they don't know how the world works. But then essentially, you know, Trump is saying, hey, guys, guess what? You're going to win the lottery. It's really exciting. Somehow these jobs are magically going to come back. And the point is that it's what comes out of a lot of all of this science is just the fact that we sort of forgot that, you know, we're religious people and we exist in belief systems. And, you know, and the point is Donald Trump has created a cargo cult. It's a religion. And, you know, the left also has a religion. And that religion, I think that, you know, what should happen is they should realize that in some ways, right, if their beliefs were scientific and reflective of how the world actually works, then they would have been able to get the world to do what they wanted to do. And they couldn't. And so now they have to really turn back to the science, see what the science says, and then draw conclusions that are more realistic. And as they do, then they will have the power to beat the right. But from having interviewed these 200 scientists here, I'm going to tell you that they all sort of know their own little field very well. They don't read outside of their field. And fundamentally, these ideas have been piling up in academia for 40, 50 years and just haven't been put into practical application.
So what would it look like to put this into practical application? I have a suggestion to start.
Okay.
One of the things that's weird about Democratic voters is that we live in the cities, and we live in really nice cities like New York City. and Los Angeles. And we have really expensive places to live, partly because of zoning laws. We have a nice place to live. I think we would get more people streaming into cities if things were less expensive in cities.
Yep.
If we welcomed people more, then it wouldn't seem like such a bubble. I think one of the reasons that we are being vilified as like living in our bubble elite cities is because people would like to live here too, but they can't afford it.
Yep.
I feel like we're just like functionally unwelcoming to outsiders, and that's a problem that we need to address.
Well, firstly, do you know what our culture is called in the psychological literature?
No, what?
It's called weird. Western, educated, industrialized, and then I can't remember what the R is, and then democratic. But so fundamentally, you have to understand that a large part of what's happened is that this weird culture, which is fundamentally unlike the culture of, you know, most of the Arab world, most of, you know, Asia, most of Africa, has been sort of off on this charge. And then they're finding that they're being pulled back, right? Because you sort of forgot about all of these other people. And you know, what the challenge is now is to, you know, we've always talked about like human potential and, you know, really enabling human potential, but in reality, we've never done a very good job of it. And fundamentally, that's because, you know, we have these terrible models for, I mean, my background's education, but we have these terrible models for how education actually works. And a lot of them, you know, I mean, Lincoln always said, if you want to understand the philosophy of the classroom in this generation is the government of the next. And so if you don't have like the government of this generation, you actually have to look back a generation to the classroom and what was going on. And there were terrible scientific ideas like behaviorism going on. The way that education is structured is all sort of stimulus response. We're going to just deliver this information to you and you're just going to sort of be conditioned into it. And the reality, that's not how humans work at all. Turns out that one of the big questions, why don't people respond to facts? Well, that's because in order to respond to facts, you have to be reasonable. And crucially, there's what's called Descartes' error, which is that thinking and feeling are separate. And in fact, they never are. Antonio Damasio and Hannah Damasio did this experiment at USC where there was a guy who had a little piece of his brain removed, and he had all these sorts of weird behaviors that emerged out of it. You know, his IQ was unaffected. He seemed smart. It seemed like they had removed a piece of the brain that did nothing. But then it turned out that he started making all these horrible decisions. You know, he left his wife. He got taken in by all these con men. And he would sit there for 4 hours and try and rationally calculate where to go to lunch based on tables and diet and all that sort of stuff. And he literally couldn't figure it out. And that's because where you want to go to lunch is a gut feeling. It's driven by emotion. And even though we're often not aware of those emotions, thinking and feeling are always linked. But there is this idea, and it took me a long time to recover it because it was very prevalent in the Harvard biochemistry department, that, you know, sometimes you're rational and sometimes you're being emotional. And I got some news for you guys.
You know, it brings me back to an earlier theme we were talking about where people sort of assumed, maybe we were talking about it off air, but like where people assume like people were born with certain talents and, you know, different races had different talents, different genders have different talents. And now we're learning about the sort of extremely strong effect of, you know, stereotype threat and that kind of thing. And I just recently, I don't know if you read Noah Smith's blog, but he had this really incredible blog post about sort of the top 1% of performance on SATs among girls and boys, and how this like long-standing argument that boys are better at math than girls because the top 1% average of SAT is so much higher than for boys than for girls. But actually, that differential, the discrepancy between the top scores, has changed dramatically in the last 30 years. And they're much, much closer than they used to be. And, you know, it's like, well, our genes haven't changed in 30 years. So what's changed here? I keep coming back to this. It's like this, it's at the end of the day, it's like what girls think they can do.
Yep.
And just as much as what their talent is.
And crucially, because thinking and feeling are linked, it's what girls feel they can do. And they've picked up those feelings from their culture. And, you know, we had Stephen Strogatz on, who wrote The Joy of X.
He's a friend of mine.
He's great. He's great. And one of the things that he told us is that, you know, it's amazing. You go into an American math department and it's a giant sausage fest. I don't know that the esteemed Stephen Strogatz used the expression sausage fest.
I'm guessing he didn't. He's kind of a gentleman.
But on the other hand, you know, you go into, you know, a Hungarian math department, it's 50-50. And that's the point is that what this all really comes down to is culture. And, you know, culture is, I mean, the finding of all of this stuff, you know, Joe Henrich's book, which we adore on this podcast, The Secret of Our Success, the conclusion is that humans are all born with the same hardware, but they run different software. And that software is culture. And just like, you know, any other piece of software, sometimes it needs to be updated. And that's what we're coming due for is a big software update.
Well, that's a perfect segue for me to talk about one of the weapons of mass destruction in my book.
Do it.
Which I think the one I want to discuss is called recidivism risk algorithms.
Mm-hmm.
These are scoring systems that judges use in order to sentence criminal defendants. And they're extremely problematic. The idea, by the way, I should mention that they were intended to help a problematic system get better. So, like, judges are sort of famously racist,
mm-hmm.
and they send black people to jail for longer for the same offense, et cetera. And so the idea was, well, let's add a sort of scientific scoring system to try to make things more consistent and more fair. But the problem is that the scores themselves are being built on data that is itself racist.
Right.
So it's kind of just extending that, it sort of created a feedback loop where you have, you know, racist outcomes, therefore people, and I should mention that recidivism risk is the risk of coming back to prison.
Right.
And you might be asking yourself, why would a judge care whether someone is likely to come back to prison? And the answer is, if you're likely to come back to prison, you're sentenced to longer. And that sort of brings up a whole other conversation. Like, why are you being, you know, why are you being punished in advance of you actually committing another crime? And the answer is, I don't know why we do that. But the problems are beyond that. It's not just that we're doing that. It's that the way we actually score people for recidivism risk is based just as much on culture. And by culture, I mean police practices. As it is on actual individual behavior. And that's because, you know, we have police practices which are extremely uneven. We have some neighborhoods have much more scrutiny by the police than other neighborhoods. So we have actual arrest data. The arrest data, and this is the way I say it, the arrest data is not the same thing as crime data. Only some people get arrested for committing crimes, and it's not evenly distributed across race.
Well,
On top of that, the other kind of data going into recidivism risk algorithms are literally questionnaires that ask questions along the lines of, did anybody in your family ever go to prison? Did you get suspended from high school? Did you finish high school? Do you have a job? Have you gotten married? These are cultural questions that are proxies for race and for class. So when you put that all together, you get a recidivism risk score, which sends black men to prison for longer.
Well, and what you do such a good job in the book of doing is basically talking about how that essentially becomes a positive feedback loop, right? Like, you come from a broken home in this environment and all that sort of stuff, so you turn to crime. So now, based on your demographic area where you live, we know that you come from an area where there's a high recidivism rate. So therefore, you're going to be a father and you're going to be in prison away from your kid. So now you've just broken another home. Right. And so you're sort of setting up this cycle to repeat. And I think that's always the interesting thing. You know, this is that there's a way to tell that story where it sort of sounds very liberal. Right. We're going to talk about racism. But, you know, there's also a very conservative way to tell that story and talk about the fact that, no, you're setting up so that kids don't have fathers. And so therefore, the families don't work. And because the families don't work, well, now you're going to have more criminals and more kids without fathers.
Yeah, it's definitely like a poverty and prison pipeline sort of circle
mm-hmm.
of a cycle, and the worst part about it, because it existed, I should say, it existed before scientific recidivism risk scores came into the picture, But the worst part about it is this idea that we have somehow improved the system with a so-called objective and fair scientific scoring system. Like, we have done nothing like that. We have just made it seem more scientific, made it seem more objective. But what we're really doing is just continuing this awful cycle.
Well, and to go back to something we were talking about before the podcast started, we have made math into a god.
Yes, we have.
Yeah. So tell me about the god of math. Is it a loving god, or is it a terrible god, or is it sometimes both?
Yeah, I mean, I think for most people, mathematics is really intimidating. Like, you were humiliated by math. You were told to memorize things without understanding them. It's very much like many people's experience with church and with the Bible, right? Like, here are the rules. Why am I learning these rules? Like, can we have a conversation about whether these rules make sense? No, that's not the point. The point is to, like, obey these rules without understanding. And then later on, like, oh, the explanation is not, it doesn't make sense to us. So we stop asking for the explanation, and we feel like the algorithm is in some sense our master that we have to obey, rather than some decision-making process that we can scrutinize and hold accountable. And we don't hold it accountable. And I would add that, like, even people who are traditionally skeptical that we can count on to sort of ask to hold truth to power, like journalists, have not historically done a very good job with technology and big data and algorithms. Journalists, generally speaking, are some of the people that are most afraid of mathematics. And many of the, I started a data journalism program at Columbia, and many of the people said, like, I went into journalism because I didn't like math, you know? And so when you combine that fear of mathematics with your job as a journalist, like, you find a lot of people just writing down the sort of marketing lines directly from the startup dude who's telling you how fantastic his new big data algorithm is for the world. So you don't get enough scrutiny on these things.
Yep.
And that's one of the large reasons I wrote the book, just to get people to say, hey, mathematical algorithms aren't inherently fair and objective. They could encode and codify racist, sexist, whatever, bad practices, mistakes that we shouldn't have been making, but that once we've automated them, we will never break out of.
And also, couldn't they encode liberal biases? I mean, they can encode any prejudice you want. Exactly.
Anything.
And I think the other interesting... just to build off of your point about journalists, I mean, that's part of the big problem is that, you know, we have a lot of communicators who don't feel comfortable with the math and science, and we have a lot of math and scientists who don't feel comfortable with communication. And that, Cathy O'Neill, is why you are such a gem and a treasure to humanity, because you're able to sit astride both worlds.
Oh, thank you. I would also add that, you know, people like Mark Zuckerberg, who make their living off of their algorithms, you know, they have conflicts of interest in really talking about any downside to algorithms.
Oh, of course.
It's really hard for them. It's like cognitive dissonance to imagine that what they're doing, which seems so great and fun, and it is fun, by the way. I should mention that I always enjoyed my work as a quant at hedge fund and as a data scientist. It is actually fun to see how close you can get to predicting what someone's going to do. It's kind of amazing, right? It seems kind of magical once it starts working. But the idea that you'd have to say, "Oh, wait a second, am I fucking up the world too?" You know, it's not a good feeling to have.
No, of course not. And
I mean, people just simply don't do it.
Well, but I mean, part of what we were also talking about before this show started, and I know that Mark Zuckerberg is a huge fan of the Brian Callen Show and just can't wait for the next episode to drop so that he knows how
I'm
to
sure
live his
true.
Life. No, but if Mark is out there and he is listening, you know, I mean, the answer is very simple. It's what Shakespeare said. There's nothing good or bad, but thinking makes it so. And if you think that math is good, then you will see only its virtues. And if you think that math is bad, you will see only its faults. But the truth is, it's just a tool. And it can be used and it can be abused. And Cathy O'Neill is here to help bring some balance to our perspective on math.
I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, and you're doing the good work, but I think that's the point is that, you know, what we've really sort of come across in doing all of this is that there aren't a lot of people who are willing to challenge intellectual power, who know how to do it. I mean, the point is there's a whole group of people who sort of don't really understand anything that's going on in academia and are just sort of like, you know, throwing certain things out, but they're not being very discerning about what they're throwing out, as opposed to people who have walked the hallowed halls, who understand the math, who understand these things, and then have the courage to be an informed whistleblower.
Yeah, you know, I kept on thinking that my book was written. All these books came out that seemed somewhat data skeptical.
Mm-hmm.
And I kept on thinking, holy shit, my book just came out. And I was like, oh, no, that's not my book.
But it
and
is.
I should add that, like, yeah. I'm actually also, if I could just, like, vent about everything in the world.
Do it.
I'm also, like, disappointed, to be completely frank, and I know you love academics, but I'm disappointed by academia.
Oh,
in
yeah.
In terms of scrutiny of big data. I mean, and I understand this situation. The situation is that, like, Facebook doesn't give access to their data. So it's not like sociologists or anthropologists or, for that matter, computer scientists could just, at a whim, go in and do some experiments because they can't. But I haven't seen much in the way of data skepticism at all coming out of academia. And I don't see it coming either, because if you look at computer scientists and how people get tenure, what kind of journals exist, and what kind of faculty lines are being invented, they are not in the world of big data skepticism. They are in the world strictly of how do you make this algorithm go faster? How do you make a neural network recognize faces? And that stuff, if anything, is going to help make, you know, bring us closer and faster to the big data dystopia that I'm so afraid of. It's not going to help avoid that at all.
Well, the problem is that science, you know, only scientific internal accountability only works when everyone doesn't have the same cultural biases. And the problem is that the same cultural biases have crept in. And, you know, there is that bias towards the liberals, and there is that bias towards the atheists. And there are people like John Haidt who are trying to correct that. But in general, like, I don't know, did you read Atul Gawande's The Mistrust of Science?
No, I haven't.
So, you know, Atul Gawande, who I love and adore, and he writes amazing books, and I've never been operated on him, but I bet he's a great doctor. But, you know, he wrote this thing, The Mistrust of Science, which was a commencement speech he gave at Caltech. And he, you know, is trying to deal with, why aren't people getting vaccinated? Why don't they believe in global warming? And you read the whole thing, and what's fascinating is that at no point does he suggest that science might be responsible for this loss of trust. It all basically comes down to the fact that, listen, science is complicated, and most people are dumb and driven by their intuition.
Right.
So
right.
Most people who, you know, are from within science read it, and they loved it. They were like, oh, this is so great. And actually, if you read it as an outsider, it's like, oh, actually what this reveals is just how clueless you are to the places in which you guys are screwing up.
If nothing else, like all the ways we constantly change people's advice, our advice on what people should eat to mm-hmm. stay healthy and to avoid cancer, like different message every year.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes me very skeptical of what we actually understand about the human body.
Well, we had, Mark Schatzker, who wrote this amazing book called The Dorito Effect. And it's all just about what has been done to the food supply since World War II. And his basic thesis is that, you know, after World War II, we focused on yield and production, and we stopped focusing on flavor. And so the result is that actually it turns out that flavor is massively important, because flavor is what, you know, triggers satiety. It's what triggers that sort of satisfying feeling of like, oh, that was awesome. I don't need any more. And so when you don't have the right sort of flavor profile, people keep on eating and eating and eating.
But, I mean, it's worse than that. It's not that we've avoided it. It's that we've actually controlled for it so that people will eat more, right?
Well, and that's the Dorito effect. You take this flavorless thing, and then you encrust it with every flavor compound possible. And so the analogy he draws is that essentially we've done the same thing to the human food supply that we've done to the cattle feed supply, where you have this bland, you know, sort of energy-rich food that you've then infused with all this flavor to get people to obsessively overeat. So we've sort of fattened up the American population like cattle. But his frustration, to your point, is the fact that, you know, he wanders around that area of academia, and that's sort of his real passion, and is constantly amazed to find that he'll find one scientist and, you know, two scientists with totally contradictory results, totally contradictory conclusions. And they're literally not bothered by this. They're not bothered that, you know, these two things don't fit, and yet you somehow both think that you're responsive to reality. And there's a lot of this. I was at a biological math conference in, I think it was January or February in Poland. And I was dating a mathematician and a biologist at the time. And she, you know, I went to some of the talks and, you know, she said, do you know that of all the people at this conference, only me and one other person are using real data? Everyone else is using simulated data, which for anybody who doesn't know, and I want to hear you talk about simulated data, but simulated data is data you make up and then draw conclusions from made up data about how reality would work.
Yeah, I got to say, like, I went to a conference in New York City a couple years ago that was billed as a big data conference, but there were academic speakers. So I was like interested in that because I'm interested in whether I'll ever have a job in academia again, basically. And I went there and the first sentence out of the guy's mouth was, let X be an infinite supply of data. You know, and I just walked out. I was like, this is not data science.
No,
this is. And by the way, I should also mention, like, sometimes I get asked by, you know, by departments of mathematics or you know, some kind of interdepartmental, you know, organizations to come talk to them about what is data science, because they want to hire a data scientist and maybe they want to start an institute of data science. And I go and talk to them about what data scientists actually do in the field. And I, of course, do as much as I can to insert the things that I worry about with respect to the field. And then I always ask them at the end, so what are the criteria by which you're going to choose your candidate for this position? And the answer is always, you know, how many NSF grants have they gotten? How many journals have they published in? You know, basically they're like, we want an academic. We don't want someone who actually works with real data about people in the field, because we do not know how to evaluate them, and we can't get it past our dean or our provost. It's really disheartening, to tell you the truth. It makes me not miss academia.
Well, but this is the conclusion that we've come to and that we're working on, and we can't do this on their own because I don't know enough about data science and I don't know enough about nutrition, and that's why we have you and we have Mark Schatzker. But we've come to the conclusion that we essentially need a scientific reformation, because much in the same way that the Catholic Church needed a reformation, at the heart of the Catholic Church was a perfect principle, which was the Golden Rule, and the institution built around it was not living it. And at the heart of the scientific establishment is a perfect principle, which is that you should change your mind in light of evidence. And the establishment is not living that. They continue to live in fantasies that are not responsive to reality. There's data that's been around for 40, 50 years, and they either haven't read it, or they're not changing their minds, or they're using simulated data, and they've sort of given up on trying to describe reality.
Yeah, so my claim for the last 4 years to every academic that is vaguely related to data science, my claim is that this is the most important field of inquiry that academia has in front of it, and it's not being worked on at all.
Yep.
And I'm hoping that the recent election, with the complete disaster in polling, the complete disaster by Clinton's big data algorithm to tell her how to campaign, and the recent claim by the campaign of Donald Trump that Facebook won him the election, might convince them that this is actually important.
They're not going to be. See, that's the basic problem that we have, right? So I'll tell you why I think we need a full-on reformation. And it's because what this comes down to, a lot of this is intuitions of authority, right? So there are, you know, and this is all from John Haidt. Like, I'm not going to tell you a single idea on this podcast that is actually my own. I'm just literally.
That's okay.
Yeah, I'm going to literally.
I sort of feel like most of my book is trying to put together stuff that is knowledge, but it's insider knowledge, right?
Exactly.
And to give it to the public in a way that they can actually understand it.
And that's
a real service.
That is the real service, and that's what we need in this moment, because that's the point, is that, you know, intellectual power matters. It matters more than ever in the information age. And unfortunately, it's not being used responsibly. It's not being used with an eye towards serving the people. And the problem is that the people don't know how to hold that intellectual power accountable. And
that's a really good point. So what do we do, man? How do we, what protests do we do?
There's
how do we take to the streets on this?
No. So what we've been doing, what we're doing over here at, so we have the Brian Callen Show, but then what we're promoting is sort of mixed mental arts, which is that you put all these different fields together and you get a worldview. Now, what it all comes down to is that there's John Haidt has this whole thing about intuitions of authority. Essentially some people feel that science is an authority and some people feel that, the Bible is an authority, right? So everybody has intuitions of authority, but we place them in different places. The problem that academia has internally, the reason why it can't solve its own problem, is because nobody in academia is now an authority on science. You might be an authority on data science, or you might be an authority on some discipline of nutrition, or you might be an authority on evolution or whatever it may be. But there's no sort of objective authority. Nobody can come out and say, this is what science says. And, science is a belief system and we need a clear doctrine. How can we be good believers if we don't know what the religion is about? So there needs to be a clarification. And essentially, we need to use external pressure where the people know what's going on and they can pressure the academics and hold them intellectually accountable. And the way that we do that is very simple. It's what you're already doing and what we're doing and what Mark Schatzker is doing. But if we band together in a group, we'll be much more effective than we are individually. And that is we pull back the curtain and we say, the great thing about science is not that it's our opinion. It's that the facts speak for themselves. And we're going to pull back the curtain and let you see what's going on back there. And then you decide whether the wizard is using his power responsibly or not. And I'll tell you the sort of things that you find when you pull back the curtain. So, for example, there's all this, I mentioned the sort of the thing about behavioral economics and sort of these people who believe in rational agent theory. Well, there's a very interesting book by a guy called Russ Roberts, who's a Stanford econ professor.
I know Russ Roberts.
Yeah. And Russ Roberts.
He interviewed me for my book, actually, just last month.
But the interesting thing is that Russ wrote this book, How Adam Smith Can Change Your Life. And the opening of the book is all about how, it's rather awkward for Russ to admit that he had never actually read Adam Smith's other book, The Theory of Moral Sentiments. And that when you do, you find out the first line of The Theory of Moral Sentiments is altruism. It's all about how people are altruistic. And then Russ has this great epiphany that actually self-interest isn't about selfishness at all. Now, that's really important because what it means is that essentially for a really long time, economists never bothered to read the Bible. They only ever read The Wealth of Nations, and that's why they had these weird ideas like rational agent theory that actually had no correlation to what Adam Smith was originally teaching.
So, I would argue that they didn't actually read The Wealth of Nations very often either.
Well, probably not, and that's the point.
I mean, because Adam Smith was plenty compassionate in that book.
And there you go.
And people misquote it all the time.
Yep.
I read it when I was breastfeeding my youngest child, by the way.
But that's what we need to do, is we need to say, like, how can you claim to understand economics if you haven't read the book? Like, you can't claim to be a Christian if you haven't read the Bible. And beyond that, there's now...
Yeah, here's what I'm uncomfortable with, where
yeah.
this is going, is that, like, one thing that I make the point of saying to people when they talk to me about my book is that it's not a math lesson. I am not asking everyone to become literate in a new way. I'm not saying everyone needs to get data literate. I think that's ridiculous, actually. And in particular, it's ridiculous. It's a ridiculous request for the people that are working, at Walmart and trying to take care of their kids and they can't get good health insurance and blah, blah, blah. Like, we have a real underclass in this country, and it's growing in no small part due to the kinds of algorithms that keep them from climbing out of their situation. And the big data algorithms, the people that need to be the most data literate are the people that have the fewest tools to become data literate. So we need to address this stuff at a society level. And it's not going to be, hey, every individual is responsible for protecting themselves.
But what I'm saying is I don't expect necessarily, like, listen, if you've got a job at Walmart and you've got 3 seconds a day to think, my point is not that you need to understand all of these arguments, right? Like, that's the job of people like you and me, right? We have to, and Mark Schatzker, we have to lead the movement and we have to be able to hold them accountable and understand these ideas and, basically be able to force them to either change their minds or step aside. But, you know, the point is that you need a movement. If you don't have the social pressure of that person at Walmart, then you don't have a movement. The three of us going and knocking on the doors of academia is not going to give them the social pressure to change. So, I mean, what we need is, I really do think that what we need, in essence, the intellectual reformation has already happened. Some people have already left the Church of Science, right? I mean, you know, they believe that global warming isn't real. They believe that, you know, vaccines are, you know, kill kids or whatever they believe. And then, you know, it's our responsibility to bring about that reformation as soon as possible so that science can do its job and science can serve the people. And the mom at Walmart doesn't have to worry about what science is up to because science is trying to figure out how to help the mom at Walmart.
Yeah, I like it. And one of the things I say a lot is what I want to do is bring the science into data science.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we are literally being asked to blindly trust and follow the decision-making of AI and algorithms. But we are given literally no evidence that they work, that they deserve our trust.
Yep.
So I, you know, if I had an infinite number of lives, one of my lives would be to write a book on the nature of evidence in the big data era and, like, what constitutes evidence. And I think that's a very important question for science, too. Like, I feel like we have gone too far in the direction of asking people just to trust us when we say blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
Like, no, we have to be able to communicate what has convinced us of this before we can ask people to trust us.
Yep. Well, and I think a large part of it is that, you know, so science for a long time has lent on those intuitions about authority to transmit ideas without people really understanding them. And then all of a sudden you gave everybody their own TV channel with social media and suddenly they're like, you know, I never really got this. And here's what makes more sense to me. And those ideas are, you know, much more appealing. They make a lot more sense. So what we're seeing is you know, this is certainly the brush had been building up, the scrub had been building up, and this is just the forest fire that is clearing it away. But the response now is not to double down on, you should trust us, you should trust us. The response is, no, we've got to win you over.
Yeah, I agree. We need to win people over. We need to give them evidence that they can understand.
100%.
And we have the technological advances required to do that in a lot of cases with algorithms.
Mm-hmm.
We just simply choose not to because it pushes against our profit margins for the most part.
Yep. And those profit margins are often grounded on those ideas that capitalism is about selfishness. And, mm-hmm. you know, most people have never read Adam Smith's two books. Like, you know, he was a tutor like I am. And I feel like, you know, tutors have to look out for each other. He's been massively misrepresented. And it's really, yeah, and it's not fair, you know, because if people actually read The Wealth of Nations and The Theory of Moral Sentiments, they'd actually be like, yeah, that makes sense. So
how long is this podcast, for God's sakes?
Well, I think we're now at the 1 hour mark, so we're going about to wrap this sucker up. But the point is that Kathy,
I don't enjoy talking to you. I do.
No, I appreciate that, but you know, I get sick of myself at some points, you know. So, so you know, I obviously you have to think about this, but you know, can we tentatively count you in for pushing for some sort of intellectual reformation?
I'm ready. And by the way, you know, going back to, like, my outsider status, I feel like when I left academia, I left that cult behind, and I haven't looked back.
Yep.
It's not something I miss. And
yep.
I feel like I've been kind of an independent scholar, as it were, since then. And I'm not particularly well off because there's no standards that I enjoy. But I'm better off than I was.
but I think that's the point is, you know, I mean, you are Martin Luther. You are, like, find that you can't, you love the principle of science, but you have a real problem with the institution. And the key is now to pressure the institution to fall in line with its principle.
That's nicely said.
Yeah. And so the point is that, you know, you're right to have left. And we don't have to do it by nailing 95 theses to the church door of Wittenberg. We can just do it with love and compassion and be like, hey, guys, you know, I know that you believe this, but there's actually other fields of science. And here's what they found out. And, you know,
I would live a half a block from Columbia and I wouldn't mind nailing something to them.
Let's do it.
Let's do it.
But so that's the point, is that what we have to do is, you know, we have to form a coalition. And it's a coalition of, you know, people who I know the ed stuff and, you know, obviously the data science stuff. And Mark Schatzker knows the nutrition stuff. And, you know, if we can build a coalition, when it's broadly going to be people who have written books about parts of the science, then we can have a pretty comprehensive worldview and be able to actually make a compelling argument that, hey, guys, some stuff needs to really change. And we've sort of been playing around with the idea of drain the swamp, make academia great again.
Wow. No. Wow. I am not in. I just rescinded. I
know. Okay. Well, I'm open to changing the marketing. But
scare off a new recruit.
Yeah. Okay. So, okay. But this is the great thing is that, you know, ultimately this is a very democratic institution. And so the point is that, you know, if I'm voted down on that one, then I will, in my mind, retweet the idea of hashtag drain the swamp and no one else needs to know about
it. Wow. Okay. Let's continue the conversation.
Yeah. Anyway, this is great, Kathy. Everybody,
thank you, Hunter.
Yeah, and the book is Weapons of Math Destruction. It's an excellent read, and Kathy is pulling back the curtain, and you know, you guys can all see what the wizard has been up to, and see whether he deserves the power with which he's been entrusted or not. And I think you'll find that often he doesn't. All right, Kathy. Thank you so much, and you're obviously
thanks
well.
Thanks for having me.
We'll be talking soon. Take care.
Great. Bye bye.
You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show with Brian Callen. Be sure to like him on Facebook. Just search for Brian Callen Comedy. And follow him on Twitter. Just search for @BrianCallen. You can also find him online by visiting his website. Just go to briancallen.com. Until next time, bye-bye.